received a call this afternoon with a prayer request that I've been asked to pass on to you. Robert Schock's father, Jackie Schock, who is in his 80s, walks with a cane, fell at a family reunion yesterday in Conway, Arkansas, and fell into a window and broke it. He cut his arm below the wrist, severing two tendons and a nerve. And so they took him to the emergency room. They did operation, did surgery. Surgery went fine, but he'll be confined to his to a care facility for the next couple of weeks. So let's keep Jackie Schock and that family in our prayers. I understand that they have cut their family reunion short because of that. So they'll be traveling. That family will be traveling back home, I think, in the morning. Last week, I decided to leap over a 400-year chasm of the intertestament period in a single bound. And I realized it was a tremendous amount of information in one lesson. But since this is the big picture, kind of a general survey, then if there's enough interest one of these days, we'll have a class somewhere in one of the classrooms on the intertestament period, do a little better job of that, because it really, really is interesting to look at some of the characters there. And by the way, a number of you didn't get a chart, and so there's some charts in the foyer, on the back of the foyer, and there is one that's taped down, and it's taped down for a reason, because I want it to stay there. And it is colored similar to your chart of the kings and the prophets in the Old Testament. And if you'll look at how it is colored and do yours likewise, I think it will become even more beneficial to you. So feel free to take as many of those as you like, except the one. I've also had to make a similar decision about the New Testament, how much time I was going to spend on it, and so I decided to spend just a little bit of time because I think we can probably wear this out. So those, again, who are interested, a series of lessons on the Caesars and their background that they provide for the New Testament is really a lot of fun, and it's really enjoyable, and it will make the New Testament come alive for you. So sometime if you'd like to do that, then we'll do that also. Our final lesson in this series, I plan to be the destruction of Jerusalem and the impact that it had on Christianity and on the Bible. Our last lesson ended with the opening of the New Testament. Rome was the world power. You'll remember Daniel's prophecy in Daniel chapter 2 as he interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And Nebuchadnezzar had a dream about a statue that was made from a number of different metals: gold, silver, bronze, iron, and then finally the feet of iron and clay. And that dream bothered him greatly because it recurred, and finally Daniel interpreted the dream for him, and he said, "You, O king, are this head of gold." And he proceeded to tell him that this figure of a man represented four world kingdoms. One of the world kingdoms had already risen and fallen, and that would be Assyria. So this is in the time of the second major world empire, and that would be Babylonia. And he will say in the interpretation in verse 44 of Daniel chapter 2, "In the days of these kings," talking about the kings of that very last empire, that empire of iron and the feet of iron and clay, he said, "In the days of these kings," and that would be the kings of Rome, "the God of heaven will set up a kingdom, which will never be destroyed, and the kingdom will not be left to other people. But it will break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." That kingdom, represented by a rock cut out of a mountain without hands, he said, will strike the image on its feet, the image will fall, and it'll be blown away like a chaff, and then that rock will grow and it will fill the whole earth. Well, the New Testament is the story of the fulfillment of that prophecy. And the fulfillment of that prophecy prophecy has to do with the church. The church is the fulfillment of all of those kingdom prophecies in both the Old Testament and the Gospels. And I include the Gospels because Jesus told lots of stories where he began and said the kingdom of heaven is like unto. And he would tell a parable or a story. Remember also, that's one way to view the connection between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Another is, if you'll remember, we began with a three-point outline of the whole Bible. We began in Genesis chapter 12. God gave to Abram three promises, a great nation, a land, and a seed promise. The great nation was, of course, Israel, the Jews, the Hebrew people, the children of Israel. That promise was fulfilled between Genesis chapter 12 and Exodus chapter 1, verse 7, where it will state about the Jews, the Hebrews, descendants of Israel, who were at that time living in Egypt, that the land, they multiplied and they grew exceedingly, and the land was filled with it. So they became a great nation of people. And then God said, I'm going to give that nation of people a land. And from Exodus chapter 1 to the end of the book of Joshua, is the story of God giving the Hebrew people, the Israelites, the land of Canaan. Joshua 21, 43 through 45 says, and God gave unto them all the land that he sware to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt in it. He continues to say, there did not fail any good thing that God sware unto their fathers, but all came to pass. And then one third promise remained. He told Abraham, or Abram at that time, his name later will become Abraham, that through your seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed. And all the way into the New Testament, Galatians chapter 3, verse 16, tells us exactly who that seed is. He said, when he spoke to Abram, and he said that through your seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed, he did not say seeds, meaning many people, but unto thy seed, singular, which is Christ. So, the New Testament is the story of how God blesses all nations of the earth through the seed of Abram, Jesus Christ. Jesus, therefore, is the fulfillment of all of the seed, Messiah promises, seed promises, and the King promise. As the theme, one of the themes that will be picked up in the Old Testament is that there's a King that's coming. And it will say when David, when God sets David on the throne, he will say, one of your seed will sit on the throne forever. And when we get to the New Testament, you have two genealogical tables that will trace Jesus' ancestry back to David to demonstrate that he has the right to claim the throne of David. And so Jesus is the fulfillment of all those seed, Messiah, King prophecies. So the New Testament is the story of the long-awaited king and his kingdom, church. And now let's take a little time and look at a little historical background of the New Testament. The first five books of the New Testament are history books. I don't know if you've ever thought about it exactly that way, but they're history books. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the history of the birth, the life, and the death of both John the Baptist in the very first part of some of those gospel accounts, primarily of Jesus. He was born of a virgin. It tells very little, almost nothing about his early childhood and his later childhood. Picks him up basically when he's 30 years old. It begins to trace the miracles that he did, the teaching that he did, and then finally his death and his resurrection. And as John will say at the end, the purpose of the gospel is to prove that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing in this, you might have life through his name. And then the book of Acts continues the history that Luke wrote both of these. And he continues, in fact, he'll start out the book of Acts, and he said, this is a continuation of the first book that I wrote. And so you go to Luke, and then you go to Acts, and you're just picking up two volumes of a history. And the Acts is the history of the beginning of the church. And you can break it down, the book of Acts, into two sections. It is, as Jesus had told his disciples, and as Paul will later say, the gospel is to be preached to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles. And Jesus had told his disciples that the gospel would begin in Jerusalem. It would spread to Judea, which was the area around it. Then it would go to Samaria, which was a northern neighbor, and then it would go to all the Gentile world. that's an outline of the book of Acts, by the way. It starts in Jerusalem. It goes to Judea, the surrounding area. And then to Samaria. There are Samaritans that are taught. And then it goes to the uttermost parts of the world. It is, there are two levels of government which will impact Jesus Christ and the early church. Actually, there's three, but I'm not going in this series to touch on one of them. Two of them will be the Roman emperors and the local governors, or the prefects, who will be appointed by Rome to be the local rulers over Judea and that area. There is a third form of government, in at least in a sense, that's a study within itself, and that's the high priest of Jesus' time and the high priest during the book of Acts and the epistles. But we're not going to really touch on that. We're going to talk about the Roman Caesars and the Roman governors that were over Judea in that area. There will be two Roman Caesars that provide a background for Jesus Christ's life. If you'll look at Luke chapter 2 with me. Luke 2. Verse 1. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor in Syria, and everyone went to his hometown to register. So, the first Caesar that will impact the story of the New Testament, and particularly the life of Jesus Christ, will be Octavian Caesar. Not very long into Octavian's rule as Caesar of Rome, he will try to return Rome to its original form of government, and the people will resist that because he's done such a good job, and so the Senate will call him Augustus. Many people have falsely thought that that actually was his name, but that was a title that they bestowed on Octavian. Octavian Caesar, Augustus Caesar, was he was Caesar between 30 B.C. and 14 A.D. So you think about that, he spread over, obviously, the birth of the life of Christ. Well, we just read that, didn't we? And depending on, it's quite a study within itself, exactly what year Jesus was born. It's pretty certain that he wasn't born in what we call the year zero. But somewhere between 2 and 6, he was born. But Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea under the reign of Augustus Caesar. And let me tell you just a little bit. In fact, I have a number of pages. I've gone through the Caesars of the New Testament and have written a synopsis of their lives. And I've boiled these down probably to a tenth, or at least thereabouts, of some really interesting things about him. Augustus' reign will be referred to as the Golden Age of Rome. Octavian Caesar survived the Second Triumvirate, which was three leaders, generals, Octavian, Mark Antony, and Lepidus. And he survived the wars that resulted from that, and whenever he finally got Mark Antony out of the way and Cleopatra out of the way in 30 B.C. at the age of 31, then he became the Caesar. And his first object or objective was to rebuild Rome after 20 years of devastating war, civil war. The Senate gratefully relinquished a major portion of its power to this benevolent dictator. He shunned personal luxury. He restored confidence in the government. He replenished the public coffers. He worked to end unemployment. He paid the military. Sounds like we might need him here. He undertook building projects to beautify Rome and instituted the Pax Romana, which is the Roman peace. It was a policy that declared that Rome was through spreading out. Now they wanted to unify the empire and concentrate on the peace and unifying the internal government. And so their foreign policy took very much a back seat, and they focused on internal things within the country. He also undertook a moral reform, which is quite interesting, with limited success. He will later agree with Horace that laws are vain when men's hearts are unchanged. He banned Asian and Egyptian cults from Rome, but he allowed the freedom of religion in the provinces, which, of course, made the Jews happy. Augustus pragmatically allowed himself to be deified, not because he wanted it, but because he saw that as a means of uniting religion and politics. Others of the Caesars will demand to be worshipped as a deity. Jesus was about 15 or 16 years old at his death. And then there was Tiberius Caesar. Tiberius ruled between 14 A.D. and 37 A.D. So that would have been during the public ministry and death of Jesus. Jesus was crucified in Jerusalem about the 17th year of Tiberius. Tiberius, at age 55, was a reluctant emperor. He had served as an outstanding general in Rome's army. He was quiet, he was reclusive, he was serious, he was well educated. He encouraged the Senate to restore the Republic, and they refused. He refused to allow himself to be worshipped or deified. He believed in law and fair trials. The provinces enjoyed as favorable a government as their history, and any in their history under Rome. Under Tiberius. At age 67, he voluntarily entered into exile on the island of Capri, and it was during this exile that Jesus was crucified. Now, that gives you a little bit of a couple of the Caesars. There are three additional Caesars that will provide the background for Acts and the Apostles, and that's Gaius, who was known as Caligula, 37 and 41 A.D., and then Claudius between 41 and 54, and Nero between 54 and 68. And I started to say I'm going to give you a little history of some of them, but I won't. We don't have the time. It's really interesting. From Tiberius, things immediately went downhill. I mean, they went off a cliff. Because the next one's Gaius Caligula. Can't help but give you just a little bit. He was an army brat. He grew up, his father was an officer, a high officer in the army, and he grew up in the army camps. And he kind of became the little kid that everybody liked to pick at and have fun with. And he evidently did well with that. And his mother found him or made him, I don't know which, or had made for him, some little boots that were exact replicas of what the soldiers wore. And he picked up a nickname, Caligula, which means little boots. And so this kid was running around the army camp, and they called him Little Boots because he had these military foot gear on. And when he became an adult, he became a really, really sorry human being, to say the least. We won't go into the details of it tonight because of sake of time. But those three will provide the background for Acts and the epistles. And it might come as a surprise to you, but probably you know by now that whenever Paul appealed to Caesar, and he went to Rome and made his appeal to Caesar, then the Caesar that he appealed to was Nero. Know anything about Nero, you know that that was a pretty interesting person for a Christian to have to come before for a trial. And then there were the Roman prefects, or the Roman governors. In Luke chapter 3, Luke is really good about giving this Roman information here. He says, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, And if you'd like, you can write over his name, 14 to 37 A.D. When Pontius Pilate, and you can write over his name, 26 to 36 A.D. The governor was the governor of Judea. And Herod, and that would be Herod, there were a number of Herods. This is Herod Antipas, and he ruled from 48 to 39 A.D. Herod Antipas was a tetrarch of Galilee. His brother Philip was a tetrarch of Iturea and Trachonitis. And Lysanias was a tetrarch of in Abilene, in Houston. During the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came to John, the son of Zechariah. So Luke gives a lot of detail. And those last two persons would be Roman governors of the provinces that are north of Galilee. So he really is specific about that. But let's look at some of the prefects here. When Archelaus, the son of Herod the Great, who was a Roman ruler of Judea, Samaria, and Idumea, died in 6 A.D. And by the way, that's one of the ways that we can date the birth of Christ and know that it was pretty close to that time. Because you remember, he was born during Herod's reign, Herod the Great. And then Herod was trying to kill whenever the Magi came through and said, "Where is he that's born king of Jews?" Then Herod said, "Well, I don't know, but when you find him, let me know so I can go worship him." And we know that an angel appeared to Joseph and Mary and told them to go to Egypt. And so they went to Egypt and fled that persecution and avoided Jesus being killed. And then word came that Herod had died, and they came back. But he said, because Archelaus, who was the son of Herod the Great, was the ruler in that area, then they went up not to Judea, but they went to Galilee. And so Jesus came to be known as a Nazarene because of that. And when he died, Archelaus died in 6 A.D., his territory was reduced to a Roman province ruled by governors appointed by Caesar. And in 41 A.D., jumping ahead, this province will be combined with Galilee, Perea, and southern Syria under Agrippa. And you'll pick up that name in the book of Acts. And between the years of 6 A.D. and 41 A.D., Judea was under the rule of 7 different governors. But we won't go through the 7, but there are 2 that will stand out as having a background for Jesus' ministry. One of them was Valerius Gracius, 15 to 26 A.D. He deposed 4 high priests and appointed 4 additional. And the last of his appointees was Caiaphas. And you'll read about Caiaphas in Matthew chapter 26, Luke chapter 3, and John 11. And then there was Pontius Pilate, 26 to 36 A.D. He was a judge who condemned Jesus to death. His allegiance to Rome, whenever he became the governor, led to hostility with the Jews. Early in his tenure as governor, he brought into Jerusalem by night military standards which bore the imperial image of Rome. They had the eagle, and he put them at the gates of the temple, and the Jews mounted a massive demonstration, or sit down, if you will, and they refused to withdraw even when Pilate threatened to kill all of them. Then they refused to move. And so he angrily removed the standards. And that will create a lot of friction between himself and the Jews. He also, there's an incident that's referred to in the Bible, he killed some of the Jewish pilgrims from Galilee while they were worshiping in the temple courts. You'll find this in Luke 13 and Luke 23. Galilee was the province of Herod Antipas. And so this created hostility between Pontius Pilate and Herod Antipas, which will be noted in Jesus' trial. You remember that? That he saw saw an opportunity, Herod saw an opportunity to try to mend some fences because of this incident that had happened, that he had killed some of Herod Antipas's people when they were in Jerusalem worshiping, created friction. And so whenever Jesus was on trial, then he honored Herod Antipas by saying, hey, why don't you hear this guy? Why don't you hear this guy? Then there were later governors of Judea under Claudius and Nero. There was Felix, there was Porcius Festus, and in 54, Nero granted Agrippa II the territories of Perea and Galilee. This, you'll find the stories of these three in Acts 24, Acts 25, and Acts 26. And Agrippa was contemporary with Felix and Porcius Festus. He was in Perea and in Galilee. So, that's a little bit of historical background, and I'm sorry we don't have time to go to the scriptures and look at those. I'll just have to trust you to do that for yourself, and I'll be glad to share these notes with you if you'd like to have them. But let's look quickly now, and finally, at some books of the books of the New Testament. There are the Gospels, and someone who was unfamiliar with the Bible would ask the question, why are there four Gospel accounts? Well, the simple answer is because each one was written to a different audience. Matthew was written to the Jews to prove that Jesus was the king, had the right to David's throne. And he'll start out with a genealogical record just to demonstrate that. And then Mark was written to the Romans. And his purpose was to prove, interestingly, Jesus the servant. You see, the Romans would have a really, really difficult time accepting Jesus because he didn't come as a conquering king. He came as a servant. And so he will write to the Romans about Jesus the servant. Luke will write to the Greeks about Christ the man, because the Greeks had lots of philosophies that would cause them to have some really strange ideas about that. And that would lead to the Gospel of John, which was written much later than the other three. The first three are called synoptic gospels. And we get the word synonym. They pretty much follow in line with one another. But then John is written much later. John is written against an early heresy that had come into the church, the Gnostic heresy. If you've ever studied the Gospel of John or John's epistles, then you probably had a little background about the Gnostic heresy. Gnosticism said that all matter was evil. It came from the Greeks. And since all matter was evil, that means that human bodies are evil. And it was not possible for God to inhabit an evil human body. And so Jesus Christ could not have been deity. And so, in a little real short course, that's Gnosticism. And so he will write that, and he will start out talking about we touched him. We handled him. We were with him. He was real. He was. Some of the Gnostics said, well, if he was the Son of God, then he was just a phantasm. If you had put your hand up to touch him, then your hand would have just gone through it. And because he wasn't real, he wasn't substance, because all matter is evil, and God couldn't inhabit a human body. And so John will write later, much later, the Gospel against this Gnostic heresy. And then the book of Acts continues with the history. Chapters 2 through 7 of Acts will be the history of the church in Jerusalem. And basically the center focal person will be the Apostle Paul. And then chapter 8, and that will go through the stoning of Stephen. The church began in Acts chapter 2 in Jerusalem. And it stayed in that area until Stephen was stoned, the first Christian martyr, in Acts chapter 7. And then in Acts chapter 8, the church scattered. And one of the places that it will know that the gospel was taken was to Antioch. And Antioch became, to the Gentiles, what Jerusalem was to the Jews. It became the place where Paul began and ended his missionary journey. The church in Antioch is the one that commissioned Paul on these missionary journeys. And so, Acts provides the historical, and don't miss this point right here, very much like Kings provides a backdrop for the prophet. Acts provides the backdrop for the epistle. You can read through the book of Acts and stop and know where Paul wrote his epistles. And know that he wrote one epistle while he was here, and then he wrote another epistle while he was here, and he wrote another epistle while he was here. So as you're reading the book of Acts, that provides a historical story in the backdrop for the epistle. Paul will write 13 epistles. The letters, there are the ones written during his three missionary journeys will be 1 Thessalonians, Galatians, 2 Thessalonians, 1 Corinthians, Romans, and 2 Corinthians. Then he will write what's termed the prison epistles while he was in jail, Philippians, Colossians, Philemon, and Ephesians. And then he will write what has been termed the pastoral epistles, because he acted, and I guess from a secular word, he acted as a pastor writing to Timothy and Titus. And so that's 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. And then there are 8 general epistles, Hebrews, James, 1, 2, 3, John, Jude. And then there's one book of prophecy, the book of Revelation, which we just finished studying with Brother Elton. And so that will provide you a little bit. Again, I know that I've jumped over lots and lots of history in a very short order. Again, I'll be glad to share my notes with you if you'd like to take some time and trace some of this down. If there's enough interest, as I said, then one day, Lord willing, we'll have a class on the intertestamental period and perhaps one on the historical background for the New Testament. Because as hopefully in this series, one of the things that you've seen is when you know some of this history, these things come alive. I mean, it just sends a chill down my spine to know that Paul appealed to Nero. And when you know something about Nero, you just think, why in the world? I'm not sure, but what I just didn't stay home and face the Jews, you know, because this was not going to be a pleasant experience. And that provides the history of Paul and his life and Jesus Christ and his life. So I hope that, I have no expectation of you remembering everything that was said in the last couple of lessons, or maybe even in the whole series. Because I often say that you have to go through something about 3 times before it really starts sticking with you. But you go over it the first time with an umbrella, and you try to see, if nothing else, it is all one story. You know, I may not know all the details of that story, but it's one story. You can see the overarching story of that. And it can, what I guess I want to accomplish with this whole series of lessons is basically one thing. I want you to understand that you can read and understand the Bible for yourself. You don't have to have some professional tell you. Now, if you have someone to study, they can help you and they can enrich your study. But you can study the Bible for yourself. You can study Isaiah for yourself. You can study Jeremiah. You can study Ezekiel for yourself. And you have a few basic tools to help you know, here's the context that this has to fit into. And when somebody jerks it out of this context and tries to make it prove something that it doesn't prove, then you can say, wait a minute. This says right here, like, for instance, the book of Revelation, these things must shortly come to pass. That gives you a context. And you don't have to be like a little bird in a nest with its mouth open and just take whatever somebody wants to cram down your throat. You have a basis for understanding the Bible for yourself. So I hope that you'll take advantage of that. It will make your Bible study and reading a lot richer. And that as you read it over and over again, you come up with these names. Then at least if you don't remember the succession of them, which, by the way, I'll be quick to tell you that I have weakest ink lasts longer than strongest mind. So you write down some things, okay? Write in the margin of your Bible. And it'll help you in your study. So if tonight there is a need that you have that can be met with a public response, this is your opportunity to do that. And we pray that you will.